You are now tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook. On this edition of PTR, we hear from correspondent Ebon Dooley, who discusses the corporate interests of a U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Dooley focuses particularly on how class has influenced the longtime civil rights leader and ex-Atlanta mayor, Andrew Young's surprise support of the war in Iraq.
Not understanding the role that class plays in all of this, because if you use race as an analytical tool, you really are using too blunt an instrument. And there are all kinds of things that it cannot explain readily without you going into what is the class position or class background of the person involved. In the case of Andrew Young, for instance, when he was on the outside banging on the door trying to get in, his position was one thing. But since he has been successful as a result of the civil rights movement, of getting involved and really having access to the inner reaches of this society, his position has changed on a lot of things.
People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publishes the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the show. We first hear from labor leader Noel Beasley, a member of the Labor Party and the Union of Needle Trades, Industrial, and Textile Employees, better known as Unite. He spoke to labor leaders at Detroit's Local 600 prior to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Beasley begins his speech by contrasting the anti-war movement during Vietnam with the anti-war movement that we can see today.
What I'd like to focus on today, though, is to talk about the opportunities that we have as trade union leaders to take the situation that we're in and to utilize our work in this anti-war movement to also rebuild the power and the influence and the credibility and the prestige of the trade union movement itself. And to talk about that, I'd like to point out some of the very stark contrasts between the situation that we find ourselves in now in 2003 and a period some 30 plus years ago at the height of the opposition to the war in Vietnam, a war which, like the imminent invasion of Iraq, exposed the core contradictions in our society at that time, as this situation, I believe, exposes the core contradictions today. In the 1960s, and many of us were a part of this movement, in spite of a booming economy, poverty was widespread. Good jobs were systematically denied to women and minorities, and billions of dollars were being spent in a war far away that many of us understood to be a war by our government for power and for influence, and not a struggle for justice and democracy. A few months ago, we lost a very important leader of our trade union movement, Tony Mazzocchi, who was the Secretary-Treasurer of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers and a founding member of the Labor Party. And I'm told that in the 1960s, Tony Mazzocchi had a map on his wall of Vietnam, and he had pinpoints of various locations of Vietnam with little flags of oil companies' names attached to them. And that was his analysis of what a significant part of the war in Vietnam was all about. And I would pose to you that we could make the same map today of Iraq, and we would drive the same message forward. In the 1960s, in spite of a legal end to segregation, the profound violence and hatred of the Jim Crow apartheid South and a highly segregated North meant that African American and Latino youth were being drafted and forced to fight on behalf of a government that failed to fight for their rights at home, a place where they had to walk and work every day, in a place where their constitutional rights were systematically diminished and constricted. And most important for our discussion here today, I think, in the 1960s, in contrast to the unity and dominance of a tiny minority of wealthy, almost exclusively white men over the levers of power in our society, the potential power of the oppressed, the disenfranchised, and the dispossessed was fragmented and broken apart and divided by our failure at that time to define clearly and convincingly to the majority of the people the characteristics of the enemies of peace and progress. And that failure on our part to build the inherent unity across the movements that potentially could have gone from opposition to the war in Vietnam to opposition to reactionary policies across our country, our failure to do that, to understand that need for clarity, for all of that we paid a terrible price in the last 30 years. And as we all know, the trade union movement in the 1960s was in a period of what now looks like relative labor management peace. And with notable exceptions, a few notable exceptions, the trade union movement uncritically supported the pro-war policies of all the various administrations that had us mired in Vietnam. As a result of all of these factors that we've listed above, as well as the assassinations of some very, very key leaders like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, the 30-plus years that have passed since the end of the war in Vietnam have been marked by hostile attacks on the rights and standards of living of working people in this country, unmatched since the reactionary tide of violence that followed the Civil War and is misnamed Reconstruction in our high school history books. Now, it goes without saying that this is not the 1960s and the early 1970s, and that we're in a very different period of time now. But I think it's critical that as trade union leaders, we develop in this very small window of time that we have here before apparently the attack will be launched, that we develop ways to talk with our members. And I want to stress that we need to talk with our members, not to our members, about this war and what it means. We need to talk with our members about our domestic crisis and its counterpart, international crisis. Because the crisis of the U.S. economy, the assault on rights and privileges in the United States, has a direct parallel and is intertwined in an interconnected fashion with the parallel international crisis. If we as leaders do this very carefully and very respectfully, then we can do something that we failed to do 30 years ago. We can position our trade union movement to lead, but not just lead the opposition to the war, but also fight for the establishment of progressive policies based on peace and justice. And we have to be able to make that curve. This is not just a question of building a movement to stop the war, even though that's the critical and fundamental position that we have to be focused on now. This is also about building our trade union movement so that we lead again the fight to return this country to a prioritization of issues of peace and justice. Now, while there are very many reasons and many valid reasons to be opposed to this invasion of Iraq that's being planned, we will be stronger and we will be more powerful as a trade union movement if we also define at the same time what we are fighting for and how support for a preemptive attack against the people of Iraq undermines every basic trade union value as well as every basic democratic value. And if we pose the issues in this way, our members, I believe, will come forward and take the leadership positions that society will demand of them. And I suspect that we have to, first of all, in any discussion and debate, begin with a very precise definition of terms, recognizing, as I think everyone in this room does, that the Bush administration is supported by the most insidious corporate-owned mass media machine that money can buy, and that we are constantly faced with having to counter an endless attempt to lobotomize the population of this country. It goes on hour after hour after hour. And very frankly, brothers and sisters, we're the only ones to counter that. And that's why when we speak, we have to speak with this kind of conviction and this kind of clarity. And so let's begin with a couple of definitions of terms. And our previous speaker already alluded to this. First of all, we have to be very clear about what terror is. Terror is a word that's now almost devoid of meaning. It's been tossed around and tossed around and manipulated and misused to apply to virtually any usage that a misleader would want to apply to it. But let's be clear about what terror is. Terror is the absence of hope. That's what terror is in all of its many forms. And we have to emphasize that the campaign of domestic terror that's been launched by the White House against the people who live in the United States and around the world, and is also endorsed by a united front of global corporations, falls squarely within that definition of terror, and that they fall squarely within the definition of terrorists. And we can give endless examples. The terror of the laid off workers from Enron and WorldCom, workers who have been deprived of their health insurance, deprived of their pensions by robber barons that would have made even the 19th century robber barons blush if they were capable of such a thing. We have retirees whose pensions and health care are being dismantled systematically by the robbing of wealth out of our country through the mismanagement and flat-out theft of wealth from our country in the stock market manipulations. We have the terror, the abject terror, of children who are being denied a future and a stake in the future by the insidious underfunding of educational opportunity in this country today that actually can only be provided by public education, which, as we know, is being dragged down in the course of this budget cutting. This is the real face of terror today. This is what terrorism is, and this is the terror that our members know because they lay awake every night afraid of these very same things and afraid to articulate them at the same time unless we lead on this issue. Now let's talk about democracy. A democracy, democratic principles that have been forcefully constricted since the Supreme Court imposed the Bush administration on the peoples of the world. There's an assault on workers' rights in the workplace that currently is going on at an unprecedented scale. And as unions attempt to organize in the context of the political and economic climate that we're in, we all understand the barriers that we're up against. Our union, Unite, is currently conducting a campaign across the United States and Canada to organize laundry workers who work for a company called Cintas. You probably, perhaps, have never heard of them. They disguise themselves even the way they spell their name. It's spelled C-I-N-T-A-S, not S-I-N-T-A-S, the way it perhaps properly should be spelled. But there are tens of thousands of workers across the United States and Canada who work under conditions of terror. And I want to particularly acknowledge in the rear of the room here some Unite organizers who are working in that Cintas campaign. Thanks for coming here today. Thanks for all your hard work. But the Cintas campaign is only one example of tens of thousands of workers who give up all of their rights when they hit a time clock and go into the workplace. The attacks on immigrants and all people of color are simply the most visible evidence of the denial of rights across the country whenever we hit a time clock and walk through the gates of a factory or a workplace. Let's talk then about weapons of mass destruction. Again, a phrase that has almost become like a football that you throw up and down the field and waiting for it to go off. I don't know about you, but I've been to Hiroshima twice, and I've been to Nagasaki once, and I know the only country on Earth that's ever crassly deployed weapons of mass destruction on a scale like that is here. So it is a constant source of amazement to me that the kind of hypocrisy that drips from the lips of the people in the Bush administration when they point their fingers at leaders around the world and talk about weapons of mass destruction and fail to say anything about the vast arsenal of weapons that's possessed on a scale here that no one else can even match. I've heard no plan from the Bush administration to deconstruct our weapons of mass destruction and set the conditions for a peaceful world. And yet we all know, as was mentioned earlier, there was Agent Orange in Vietnam that was turned against the entire population of Vietnam, and we know from the evidence that we saw the price that Vietnamese people paid because we know the price that we paid here. So let's define our terms and let's move on from there. From here we can point out to our members that every crisis we face at the bargaining table is a product of the hostile policies of the Bush administration, and we can combine this political education with this anti-war movement and we can build our presence in our locals to fight these very insidious leaders and misleaders. Let's talk about next steps. First of all, let's recognize that solutions are being proposed, that concrete solutions do exist to the problems of healthcare and society, the problems of retirement income, and the problems of the destruction of higher public education, free education. Let's craft our resolutions against the war within the context of the local unions that we're in. I don't think it's enough to just sign off on someone else's resolution against the war. We should involve our members in their workplace, in our workplaces, in the discussion, and the resolution should be crafted from the experience of our members. This will be far more important than simply signing off on the U.S. Labor Against the War resolution or anyone else's, because it will be a product then of a genuine discussion and a genuine debate, just as occurred here in this local union of the UAW. I would encourage you all to affiliate your locals and your district councils with U.S. Labor Against the War. It's absolutely critical that that organization be nourished and grow in this period of time before the attack is actually launched. And we should attend rallies. We should attend events like this whenever we have the opportunity. We should broaden and deepen our coalitions and build those bases that we have with the environmental movement, with other community organizations, because that will be ultimately the force that will have us prevail. And finally, let's come up with the best slogans that we've ever had. I just want to share with you my three favorite slogans so far. No Iraqi stole my 401k. I think that's a pretty good slogan. My second favorite, how did our oil get under their sand? Which I think kind of sums up the oil content of this. And finally, my favorite of all, regime change begins at home. Thank you, brothers and sisters.
You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. You were just listening to Noel Beasley, a member of Unite and the Labor Party, talk about the role labor leaders play within the anti-war movement. Next up on PTR, you will hear from Atlanta PTR correspondent Ebon Dooley.
This is in response to a call I had gotten from a listener who called in concerned about the position that Andrew Young had taken with regard to the war. She called in and said that she knew of Andrew Young's civil rights background, and she was somewhat surprised that he had come out in support of the war. And it was a newscast here in Atlanta about that. Also, I was listening the other day when Reverend Lowry, who is head of the SCLC, expressed a similar concern. And he said that given Andrew's background and everything, he was surprised that he would support the war. And he said, well, I haven't had a chance to talk to Andy, but I'm sure he'll have an explanation when we do talk. The problem that they have in terms of that particular analysis is they're just looking at Andrew Young from the perspective of being a black civil rights activist and not understanding the role that class plays in all of this. Because if you use race as an analytical tool, you really are using too blunt an instrument. And there are all kinds of things that it cannot explain readily without you going into what is the class position or class background of the person involved. In the case of Andrew Young, for instance, when he was on the outside banging on the door trying to get in, his position was one thing. But since he has been successful as a result of the civil rights movement, of getting involved and really having access to the inner reaches of this society, his position has changed on a lot of things. For instance, during the original Desert Storm, Andrew Young had used his position as former UN ambassador to make all kinds of contacts with people in the developing world, heads of states, investors, and people of that sort. And he was able to parlay that into getting a position with Law Industries in the first instance. And Law Industries is one of the world's largest construction companies. And through Andrew Young's antecedents in the matter, they were able to get a contract to rebuild the airport in Kuwait City. And his reward for that was he was made vice president of Law Industries. And he's been very instrumental in them getting contracts all over the developing world. So when it comes to this particular war, it wasn't difficult for him to justify to himself his position that all of a sudden this becomes a just endeavor and something that he should support. Because, frankly, his position is he's going to benefit personally, and those around him are going to benefit from this particular intervention. So when Lowry says, well, I just don't understand it, Andrew, as a civil rights person, it may not be understandable, but as a rising member of the ruling class in this country, or as an aspirant to that position, his position becomes very understandable. And that's the kind of thing that we talk about here on WRFG, how we have to look beneath the surface and how we have to examine why people take certain positions. It's not enough to look at a politician and say, well, this politician is an African American and hence should or should not hold certain positions. But if you look at some of the other factors involved, particularly when it comes to some of the people who are involved in the government, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, and various people of that ilk, you can begin to understand some of the positions that they take when it comes to that. And after discussing that with the listener, she was in agreement that we really do have to have a sharper tool of analysis, and just looking at race or ethnicity or any of these other things is not enough. We really do have to see how these people line up in relationship to the ruling class.
Before we conclude this edition of PTR, we have a commentary written by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America's People's Tribune and read by Sierra Howlett.
The United States invasion of the Middle East has galvanized people across the world. Millions of people, including hundreds of thousands in America, have poured into the streets to demand peace. But this is not like any previous movement for peace. Given the nature of the time in which we live, the call for peace today is a revolutionary demand. It is a demand for a new society, for a new world, for a new relationship among human beings. There is a growing mass consciousness that civilians, not soldiers, suffer the most in war. Modern war has become such a threat to the majority of the people that they are demanding an end to war as an instrument of national policy. Yet the competition among capitalist nations over markets and resources breeds war. War is an inevitable byproduct of capitalism. Thus, the demand for peace is the demand for a new kind of society. We will never have peace under capitalism. While the U.S. and other capitalist countries may appear powerful, the capitalist system is being undermined by historical forces. Under capitalism, high technology is creating massive unemployment and widespread destitution. While a handful of people wallow in vast wealth, half of humanity lives on a few dollars a day, and poverty is growing by leaps and bounds worldwide. High technology has created the possibility of a humanity that is prosperous and at peace. But so long as a tiny group of capitalists own and control the economy and the wealth that our labor produces, the mass of people can never realize technology's promise. And we will continue not only to have war, but to live under a worsening repression. Since the capitalists can no longer provide jobs, they must create police states to contain populations that are increasingly poor and angry. And the threat of outright fascism looms on the horizon. Yet there is hope. The growing mass of poor in America and the world represent an irresistible force for change. They are compelled to fight for a new cooperative society. Such a society would use technology's abundance to satisfy human needs and would have no need to attack other countries. There are only two paths open to us. One leads to a new society, to peace and prosperity, while the other leads to growing repression and endless cycles of war that, unless the people stop it, will culminate in world war and the nuclear destruction of humanity. The people will not automatically choose the right path. They have been lied to, and they need to be told the truth. Which path humanity follows depends on the activity of conscious people, of revolutionaries. If the people do not wrest political and economic power from the hands of capitalists, our world will be destroyed. It's that simple. The war makers will not give us peace. Rather, peace must be imposed on the war makers by the people. The role of revolutionaries is to make the people understand that they are really fighting for a new society, to make them see that the reforms they seek will only come about as a byproduct of revolution. To play this role effectively, the revolutionaries must come together in a national organization. We cannot fight effectively as individuals. The League of Revolutionaries for a New America is committed to gathering the revolutionaries together and winning them to a vision of a cooperative society so that we can help put America on the path to peace and prosperity. If you agree that this is what needs to be done, join us and help carry out this program. Please contact us. Let's talk.
The old era is over. The future is up to us. The attack on Iraq is another horrific sign of the end of an era. With this war, the Bush regime has announced that it will attack any country, wreck any international institution, and trample on any civil liberty that gets in its way. The Bush regime plans to dominate the entire planet. We are living in a decisive moment in history. A tiny class of millionaires and billionaires rules this planet. This class has a very clear idea of what it wants for the future of humanity, a perpetual winter of bombs, prison camps, and sweatshops. But that is not the only possible future. The same vast economic changes that have destroyed the industrial era and its stability have also unleashed the possibility of ending poverty once and for all. If the ruling class can try to plunge the world into a long, dark night where the injustice continues indefinitely, we can work to bring about a new dawn. A world in which the extraordinary new technology, which is creating a world of plenty, is controlled by the majority of humanity. This hour is not a time for small goals. There is no possibility of returning to the past. We are living in a seed time, a moment out of which an entire new era will be born. It must not be a police state and a world forever at war. It can still be a world which nurtures the peaceful, equal, and full development of all people. Let us be as firm and decisive as the enemies of peace are, and think with every bit as much vision. The future of humanity is up to us. That concludes another edition of People's Tribune Radio. PTR is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society with economic and social justice for all. If you would like to contact the League or order more information about our print and other media publications, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888. That's 1-800-691-6888. Or on the internet at www.lrna.org. My name is Kenny Shook, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.